Are there any questions? So he hears me talking a lot about the deep place in us that knows, yeah? And how much to have our energy towards go straight there, if possible, as much as possible. And how much to work with how there's resistance to our pain and trying to find a way to let go of resistance to that pain so that we fall into the deep place. So, in other words, how much to work with connecting to deep wisdom and its in its sweetness, and finding our ways there, and growing our capacity in that, to bear that and to live in that. And how much to, usually we talk about work with the negative, the difficult, the painful. And he's giving the clue of, really, it's mostly we work with resistance to the difficult. Usually, usually I say no rules at all, but I usually do have the guideline of 80-90% go there to the sweet. And grow the capacity to sniff it out and fall in, and 10-20% with the difficult. But it seems like on this retreat, there's sometimes more need of some good full time with that difficult, which means there's a great capacity to find our tenderness that can meet the pain as pain. I find mostly resistance to the pain comes when I'm not really that much in touch with the pain. I'm being driven by it. I would say I'm constantly in touch with the pain, but I'm not really. I'm really moved by my fear of the pain and my misunderstanding of the pain. And so growing the friendliness inside and outside helps too, when possible, that we get invited in. The pain invites us to feel simply hurt. And that immediately allows, like, the wildness of life just comes. And there can be healing. And then we start to notice that life doesn't have to be around pain, pleasure. We do start to notice we can give ourselves really fully into the deep sweet. The word knowing, not sure. Yes, but if we can give up what we think knowing is, it feels like going blind and having to feel our way along. It's such a different kind of eyes. And we do not like that. We want to see first, and then, okay, then I'll feel my way over there. I was asked to consider revisiting the story from the first evening from this book, and also quite a few people asking, what was the name of that book again? This is one copy. It's first came out in 1976. Some of you were not born. Some of you were. And it's The Education of Little Tree. One of the things that Little Tree learns is that when you have something good, what to do. Grandma said, when you come on something good, first thing to do is share it with whoever you can find. That way, the good spreads out where no telling it will go, which is right. And so in finding our way to what is real, starting to practice feeling our situation and knowing the difference between what is my reactive energy in the situation and what is the energy of the situation, which is it's still similar kind of two parts of our practice. What is my reactivity? How does it feel? How does it act? What happens next? And what is actually here and available and possible? Both in really simple, ordinary ways and in that very subtle, also ordinary, but deep way. Feeling my own reactivity, the way my self is already like twisted into a shape that's not my shape. And any little touch, like a mousetrap. Again, another shape that's not my shape. Starting to come to feel the shape, the simple fact of twist, that is a not home feeling. It's a good feeling to be able to notice. It kind of like dawn, it happens like dawn, kind of like the day starts very early and really takes its time to come. And the whole time, it's changing all the time. The sounds, the light, the creatures, what they're doing. Similarly, it starts to dawn on me. There's the twist, one of the twists. So we're not out to find the twist and kill it or fix it. And so part of our practice is being able to bear that there's twist. And to trust that within twist, aliveness, we could say, knows what to do. And we'll find out after it happens what happened, how untwisting came. We can really play with, in a couple of ways, noticing what's involved in that reactivity or charge or twist, that not at home. this morning the words on guard came. And one way that we've been mentioning mostly every day is playing with perception. And somehow in this heat, it can be easier to access in a way. Partly because we go out the door and it's hot. It's noticeable. And we can play with just hot. And we can play with reactivity to hot. Which could be, I'm going to dominate this hot. I'm going to make myself love it. Or, wow, how can I love this? I don't love this. It's not safe to love this. And, for example, with seeing, a way that we could play with, it's almost like letting my usual seeing leave my eyes just open so that the meeting with color happens. Just walking along. And here we're walking along on flower petals. You know, it's like a fairy tale. And then also cement. So it's that kind of surreal fairy tale. Cement and flower petals. And there can be a kind of strange feeling or phenomena where it's almost like we've left space in our eyes and in our vision. And that allows the color to be more, like turns up, more intense, more alive. Playing with that, you can also look at any object with a little appreciation. And something similar can happen. And so it's a matter of allowing some kind of wall to come down, just in perceiving. And similarly with people, we can and need to start to notice what wall feels like. I'm having a hard day, so you're all out to get me because you're all better than me, or you're so whatever. Fast or slow or whatever. And one way to play with having the wall come down, it's not automatic, but one way to play with having it come down is knowing we've all been there, and some of us are there. You're having a hard day, so is 30% of the room. You feel fear, so do I. You feel pressure, so do I. And so then we start to, on purpose, know, okay, look, I'm having a hard time and I can feel how I'm kind of in my turtle shell. And the last thing I want to do is come out of the turtle shell. But if I just peek out, maybe don't come out, peek out, look, and just in case someone else is peeking out of their shell, which they are. So there's this aspect of bearing. Bearing that fear that would stop you from even peeking or guessing. They also feel insecure, or they're also struggling with up and down, giving up, hating themselves, whatever. Or sometimes people on a silent retreat look around and say, oh, they're so depressed. Looking at the ground, not laughing, not smiling. And again, it's my own reactivity in the situation and not the real situation. So especially I want to have that we have the chance to feel when we do aloneness. So many times there's a deep longing for connection. And I mentioned also the first evening, I think, a friend of mine who, when she discovered, I am the connection. So feeling for the deep openness to be together, to be in a situation, to be actually in a situation and not in a shell, to be in life, to be alive. And many times, not on retreat, people have the sense that no one around them shares the same deep wish for freedom or to find another way or to question. And then we do aloneness. So even though my deepest wish is that we could together feel for another a shift, my most common act inside is to close. And to discover that again, to discover that. If we find that the deep wish is to be open to life and to share it, to share that deep calling. If we find that what we most often have happening inside is kind of like, if you don't want to play my way, then I'll play alone. Even though the only play I want to play is with you or somebody. It would be easy to notice that in ourselves and hurt ourselves more. We see ourselves hurt ourselves. I want connection, but I'm closing. And it's all my fault or whatever, kind of hurtful thought. And then we get to bear, we have the chance to bear that it's not my fault. It's a natural happening. That in the face of all the openness and mutual influence, in the face of the fact of all of our connection and my own deep longing to live that connection, in the face of that, naturally fear happens, naturally closing happens. It doesn't mean that's our only option, that's why we're here, but that's a natural occurrence. And then we feel for what's deeply, more deeply natural, dropping into where. In the family of Little Tree, the word that they use when they want to say they feel connected, they honor, they love, they respect. So, late at night, Grandma and Grandpa would say to each other, I kin you. I kin you. So, kin. Yeah, I'll tell you. Kin usually means we're related by blood. You're my sister, my mother, my father, my cousin, my great-great-grandparent or whatever. And then we talk about kindred spirit or kindred heart. So it's not, it's a different kind of blood. To bear kinship, we also take kinship, the fact of are being related. In other words, to bear the fact that even though I close, even though closing happens, openness is. And not only is openness a fact, we can't get away from our openness, which includes caring and vulnerability, exchange. There's the fact of openness, and there's like giving in to and living openness. Someone asked me to speak about courage, and I'm using the word bear. Bear can mean carrying something, or it can mean giving birth to something, or having the child inside before it comes out. And it can mean learning not to listen to the freaking out. Because life is precious. In the moments that we experience preciousness of life, it's both like your life is precious and powerful. And your presence makes a difference. Your particular presence in this room right now is making a difference. And when we bear that, it's another form of openness. We realize it makes a difference to be here. Always, wherever you go. You can't stop making a difference. Burying that is not always easy. You can feel exposed, we feel uncertain. We start to get the kind of message, we get the experience, makes an impression that this particular life is precious, powerful, makes a difference. And it's not mine. And the more we let those two contradictory kind of powers overlap, everything that you do and think makes a difference. And it's not your thinking. It's not really your life. None of us know how to make a life. We actually don't know what it is that's going on. The most basic foundation of what we're doing and all of our questions, we don't know. And every aspect of it, thinking, feeling, body, kinning, and we can just simply notice in our experience gradually. Let's say a wonderful or a slightly good feeling comes, maybe in meditation or maybe walking over the flowers. Or tasting the food or whatever. The moment that we think, it's mine, I did it, this is complete, I'm done. Any of those statements. The goodness is now inaccessible. It's gone. And as soon as I again let go, that this just is good. I don't know how this is going on, but this is good. Again. Gautam Buddha talks about it as if we see the shadow of a leaf and the sunshine next to it. Where there's the shadow, there's not the sunshine. Where there's the sunshine, there's not the shadow. So gradually burying that place of, it's so particularly here, right? So intimate in me. And there's not really a me that, to have it. And there's not really a having. As soon as there's a having, the experience is changed completely. And then we let go of the having, let it be again. And so when we hear in the mind the kind of thought of this is the only way, or this is it, this is final, just notice that now that experience is gone. And immediately is back available. We might not be soaked in it. I have a funny poem from Wendell Berry, an American poet who's still living, as far as I know, if he didn't die today, from 2005. It's just called Number 14. And it says, God, how I hate the names of the body's chemicals and anatomy, the frore and glum department of its parts, each alone in the scattering of the experts of Babel. So all the names that take the body apart. So that there's not understanding, there's not kinning anymore. Not understanding. The body is a single creature, whole. Its life is one, never less than one or more. So is its world, and so are two bodies in their love for one another, one. In ignorance of this, we talk ourselves to death. I want you to have the chance to feel for a remembering of what you've always known, as Odilia spoke some yesterday so beautifully. That there is this, particular, limited, and it can seem apart. There is this specific body, life, mind, situation, event, etc. And just as Odilia G did in the yoga class this morning, like feeling the ground, the root, and feeling that which knows the infinite is here. And it was so lovely how she said, like, let the arms reach for or towards the intimate. I was getting this through translation and my own morning brain, so forgive me for being less poetic, but reaching for the infinite with the arms, an actual reach, that's not 100% extension. So we can feel the fullness of reaching and touching the infinite, and the root, the ground, the here, the ordinary, what we think of as ordinary, as one thing. And the fact that in that oneness, which is a practice, tuning in to that, that doesn't make sense to the mind, the seemingly limited body, mind, is in touch with, right now, something that does not have limit. And we can taste it. Bearing the taste. And then, again, though there's everything here, it doesn't mean we block out. So though we don't demand or require from the world, from other people, to fill me, if we block out other people, because they might not meet me the way I want, if we block out, then we've lost touch with our taste. Taste. The taste of root and sky. And that taste, if I may use that word, I use it because it's a non-mental but definite experience, subtle, that we can practice receiving. Is self-fulfilling, self-confirming. So usually we have an experience, maybe a good experience, let's say. We feel some joy or some confidence or ease. There's some shift, and for a moment there's not mind in the normal way, for example. And then usually something quickly wants to come and make sure that was that. Was that really that? And so this practice of, even though that movement happens, staying. If we get into a conversation with that wanting confirmation, it goes on forever. And if we just stay anyway, though it's a bit noisy in our head or whatever, we start to find that it's self-confirming the goodness of the taste. And this is the growing of courage. To stay with that taste. And slowly we find that we are willing to lose things to stay with that taste. We're willing to break an idea, to lose our loyalty to an idea. So, small example. Big for the person, but someone I know who loved sitting meditation and then had an accident and was too painful to sit. And he was in despair because the one thing he loved was sitting meditation. And now he couldn't sit. But he did come somehow, something in him more intelligent than that dead end feeling, came on a 10-day retreat where people were sitting. This was before I had the courage to ask people to lie down. I did it myself, but I didn't yet have the courage to share that goodness. Didn't know it was allowed, which it isn't. But meeting him helped me realize. So I said, well, you know, you can sit in the chair. He said, it's not the same. I said, I know it's not the same. It's true. Everything makes a difference. Sitting on the ground is one thing. Sitting in a chair is another thing. But you love to sit. It's not the same. Well, what if you lie on the ground? And I think his whole body just went rigid with shock. He went white. Partly because he heard me, really. And partly because there was no way he was going to lie down. And it really struck me, like, wow, what he loves most to do is to sit. Because, why? He loves meditation. And he's used to meditating that way. And now life is calling and saying, hey, what you love is meditation. And accepts the challenge as a gift. Standing, eating, chair, ground. And I don't know how, because he got so afraid of me. I don't know what happened exactly in those 10 days for him, but he found a way to keep meditating, not killing his body. This is a magic book. It's called This Day, Collected and New Sabbath Poems. So I call him Wendell instead of Mr. Barry or whatever when I'm by myself. And some days I'm just like, all right, Wendell, what do you got for me? And, you know, I don't know how many pages are marked in this book, but probably more than half. And today I found two poems I had never read before because Wendell had something for me, which is right next to number 14, number 13. So Odelia used the word infinity today, which was very moving, really touched me. And Wendell is going against the word infinity, using the word eternity to mean the same. So eternity is not infinity. It is not a long time. So eternity is not a long time. It does not begin at the end of time. It does not run parallel to time. In its entirety, it always was. In its entirety, it will always be. It is entirely present, always. Eternity is not infinity. It is not a long time. It does not begin at the end of time. It does not run parallel to time. In its entirety, fullness, completeness, it always was. In its entirety, it will always be. It is entirely present, always. So we're supposed to have titles for the talks here. I'm like Odelia, usually I don't. And so the title is Purna, which is a Sanskrit word, Purna. That means fullness or completeness, or he's saying entirety. And the taste of root and infinity as one thing that invites your courage to move you. To remember what you've always known, both in really actually specific things, historical things that you've always remembered but not remembered. That kind of dawning. I remember when I remembered something bad that had happened as a child to me. There were certain things I always knew, always remembered. And then through practice, being still and being quiet and love, being in India in my life. I remembered what I'd always known, fully enough for there to be a response. And there's also this deep remembering of what we've always known. So the taste is partly a wholeness that has room for like real specific wound and also recovery of actual innocence and the wisdom that comes of when the meeting of innocence and wound. There's also another kind of remembering which can be shocking. Remembering in that sense of coming back together. Things that had seemed separate, different members, they come back together. And that's meeting our blind spot can be really shocking. It's kind of easy to find if you want to find it. The recipe is whenever you should wish. What most gets your reactivity going? You might notice in other people, especially how they're too fast or they're too slow or whatever. And that's about you. But there is, and there might be more than one blind spot, that when we find it, some part we can't believe. The person who is always angry, that there's kindness. The person who's always sad, that there's joy. The person who's always kind, that there's fierce rage, violence. And it's a way of like trusting wholeness, that there is a way that things fit together in wholeness. And when we let it be whole, they can find their way of fitting. Are there any questions so far? Okay, I heard three kind of at once. Haga? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good. Good. Yeah, good. Yeah, good. Okay, great. Good observation. She's saying it's understandable that the blind spot is easy to find, to locate. But she's saying when I try to go there, what I actually find is resistance. Or reluctance. And what was the Hebrew word? Or, okay, so. In the Kedut. Okay. I won't try. Good. So then, there can start to be more interest and gathering resources to simply feel, this is what resistance feels like. What's operating here is resistance. This is where resistance starts, over here. And it brings out a pain over here. And it spills those words out of my mouth. Or into my head or whatever. And what helps the part that freaks out at maybe the possibility that I am that, or that they might see that in me, or whatever the freak out reason is. What helps what freaks out to calm down and feel safe? Actually loved. So we find out why the resistance. I can't bear to love myself as I am. I can't bear the possibility of being loved. And then what gets active and empowered is self-hatred, self-sabotage. And the whole thing, there's resistance to feeling, meeting. So this morning I talked about like feeling or seeing through the bully boss to the pain. And now I'm saying in another way, something similar. What gives the power and why to the bully boss? And what's really needed? Many times it happens. It's strange to watch it or feel it unfold. When the deepest need for love, for example. But actually, when love is present, a complete freak out. People literally running away, literally. Because it's so hard to bear receiving what was needed. What is needed. And this is the other side of bearing, and that when we find something good, share it with someone you come across as soon as possible. Kind of. When there's a need, part of our practice is calming down into the fact of need, and that automatically allows receiving. So we start to clear the way. It's not neediness. It's not demand. A lot of things that I really believe that I need, I don't. A lot of things that by habit I seem to need, I don't. But there is need. And it is a strong practice to find our way there where the openness in the form of need receives. So if we feel what resistance feels like, sort of like wrapped around the whole machine of pain and bully, etc. Pain, wound, and activated wound. Or moving from lack and fear. Feeling for the whisper of okayness and letting things reorient, staying there. And we also bear transformation. We bear now being a different person. Shiri? What was the last part? You can hardly choose another way. Stiffness. Yeah. Okay. So she's like, no problem, I got the reactivity. I know. I feel it, I know it. And I don't often find choice to not go into the reactivity. She said there's a stiffness. One great thing in that situation, other than also being humbled by, wah, is we really get to see how the patterns, the way we got shaped, and the way life hits us and comes out reactive, is really not our own. We can really get that pattern is not me, it's not myself, it's not mine. And that, just having that little bit of space, so less chance for guilt and shame and blame to be bothered to enter and make it more complicated. The fact that, wow, this is beyond me as I know me. And this is not me. Gives a little bit more space to start to feel for what else? What's the deeper nature and what helps me align with that? And this is also bearing how much failure there is. How many times we catch reactivity again. And then also take it personally. And in a way, when that person just finally gives up, because that person doesn't have the power to stop the reactivity. It's true. It's something more round and deep that allows the transformation, that allows us to come into what Gautam Buddha talks about as three. Taints is the word. It's almost like food that's been poisoned or it's gone off. And so it makes us experience what's not real as real. And one is the place of lack. We eat that as if it's food and we can't function properly. We move from the place of lack, fear, instead of wholeness, where, yeah, there is small mind, there is hatred, etc., and there's kinship. The taint of being is where we assume that we are a solid and that experience is a solid thing that goes on, when actually our experience, there's so many holes in it, so many shifts, so many actually things we could feel into and work with. So even bodily discomfort, sometimes just feeling that it's changing, whether it's changing with the breath or just in its own way, really helps something release. Similarly with our patterns. It's really brave to notice this is the same pattern again and again and again. It's repetitive, it's not alive. The aliveness is trapped in something not alive. But to feel for the aliveness even in the pattern helps it start to free itself. And then the taint of ignorance, which is that turning away from the fact of kin, of a whole, of entirety always present, that is not insulted by me getting reactive. So even me getting reactive, the reactivity takes over my actions, and it is a pity. And not my fault. And there's a way to wiggle and find. And the fact that it hurts, that reactivity, can help me wiggle and find humbly some other way. Each time different. Ignoring that there is infinity, that there is eternity. Or ignoring that there is limited particular. If it's okay, I want to actually read a little of the story as I promised. I'd like to read parts of the actual book. We went to church every Sunday. We walked the same trail that me and Grandpa used to deliver our wares. It was what they sold to make money. For the church was a mile past the crossroads store. We had to leave at daybreak, for it was a long walk. Grandpa put on his black suit and the meal sack shirt that Grandma had bleached white. So if you think of a bag that might have flour in it, it's usually brown. So they bleached it white and made homemade shirt. I had one too and wore clean overalls. Looked like jeans that come over the shoulders. Me and Grandpa buttoned the top buttons on our shirts, which made us proper for church. And they talk about the shoes Grandpa wore that were really uncomfortable because he was used to wearing moccasins, the handmade Indian shoes. Me and Grandma had it easier. We wore moccasins. I was proud of how Grandma looked. Every Sunday she wore a dress that was orange and gold and blue and red. It struck her at the ankles and mushroomed out around her. She looked like a spring flower floating down the trail. If it hadn't been for the dress and Grandma enjoying the outing so much, I suspicioned that Grandpa would never have gone to church. Not counting the shoes, he never taken much to churching. Grandpa said the preacher and the deacons, who are like the authorities in the church, pretty much had a chokehold on religion. He said they done the determining, like the deciding, on who was going to hell and who wasn't. And if a feller, if somebody didn't watch it, pretty soon we're worshiping the preacher and the deacons. So he said to hell with it, but he didn't complain. I liked the walk to church. We didn't have to carry our load of wares, and as we walked the cut-off trail, day broke ahead of us. The sun hit the dew on the valley down below and made tree patterns where we walked. The church set back off in a scope of trees. It was little and wasn't painted, but it was neat. Every Sunday, when we walked into the church clearing, so outside the church, Grandma stopped to talk to some women. But me and Grandpa headed straight for Willow John. He always stood back in the trees, away from the people and the church. He was older than Grandpa, but he was as tall. Full Cherokee. Do you know what that is? So one of the peoples of Native America. It's called Cherokee. Full Cherokee with white plaited hair hanging below his shoulders, so braids, and a flat brimmed hat pulled low to his eyes, like the eyes were private. When he looked at you, you knew why. The eyes were black, open wounds, not angry wounds, but dead wounds that lay bare without life. You couldn't tell if the eyes were dim, so not bright, or if Willow John was looking past you into a dimness far away. Once in later years, an Apache, so another kind of Native American Indian, showed me a picture of an old man, a photo. It was Goklaye, Geronimo. He had the eyes of Willow John. He was a very famous Indian warrior who didn't win, but didn't give up his living. Willow John was over 80. Grandpa said that long ago, Willow John had gone to the nations. So that meant he went to where the United States government had sent his people, like many, many days walk away, completely different ecosystem. There had been an agreement, a paper signed, that the Cherokee could stay in certain parts of their own land, and the U.S. government would take certain parts of their land. And then they signed that paper, and then the meaning of the paper changed afterwards, and they were made to go. And so we always walked to him, standing back in the trees. Grandpa and Willow John put their arms around each other and held each other for a long time. Two tall, old men with big hats. And they didn't say anything. Then Grandma would come, and Willow John would stoop, like bend over. And they would hold each other for a long time. Willow John lived past the church, far back in the mountains, and so the church being about halfway between us, it was the place they could meet. Maybe children know. I told Willow John that there was going to be lots of Cherokees before too long. I told him I was going to be a Cherokee. So Little Tree is part Cherokee and part European. I told him I was going to be a Cherokee. So in his living, so-called education, in his living, he's getting an understanding of a way of being. We would call Dharma, he calls Cherokee. And so he's reshaping the meaning of the word through his experience. By being accepted as someone who could live in nature, kinning, bearing, he feels it an honor to be. We could even say human being. Before too long, it would be like the child would say, there's going to be lots of human beings before too long. Real human beings. I told him I was going to be a human being. That Grandma said I was natural born to the mountains and had the feeling of the trees. Willow John touched my shoulder and his eyes showed a far back twinkle. Grandma said it was the first time he had looked like that in many years. So then one time at church, after that, they had their way of sitting in the church. They each had their place. And the way they sat was Willow John, Grandma holding Willow John's hand, Little Tree, Grandpa. Arm around to Grandma. So Little Tree holds Grandma's other hand and Grandpa's leg. In Little Tree's seat in the church, one time, in his place, I found a long knife laying where I sat. It was as long as Grandpa's and had a deer skin sheath that was fringed. So the cover was also handmade, decorated. Grandma said Willow John gave it to me. That's the way Indians give gifts. They do not present it unless they mean it and are doing it for a reason. They leave it for you to find. For us, this is more happens in life events than with people because there's so few human beings now. You would not get the gift if you didn't deserve it, and so it's foolish to thank somebody for something you deserve. Or make a show of it, which is reasonable. I give Willow John a nickel, which is 5 cents, and a bullfrog. The Sunday I brought it, Willow John had hung his coat on a tree while he waited for us. And so I slipped the bullfrog and the nickel into his pocket. It was a big bullfrog I had caught in the spring branch in the stream and had fed bugs until it was practical a giant. Willow John put on his coat and went into church. The preacher called for everybody to bow their heads. It was quiet so that you could hear people breathing. The preacher said, Lord. And then the bullfrog said, Laru, deep and loud. Everybody jumped and one man ran out of the church. A feller hollered, God Almighty, and a woman screamed, Praise the Lord! Willow John jumped too. He reached his hand in his pocket, but he didn't take out the frog. He looked over at me, and the twinkle come again to his eyes, this time not so far back. Then he smiled. The smile broke across his face, wider and wider. And he laughed, a deep, booming laugh that made everybody look at him. He didn't pay any attention to them at all. I was scared, but I laughed too. Tears commenced to water in his eyes and roll down the creases and wrinkles of his face. Willow John cried. Everybody got quiet. The preacher stood with his mouth open and watched. Willow John paid no attention to anybody. He didn't make a sound, but his chest heaved like going up and down like the sea. And his shoulders shook, and he cried a long time. People looked away, but Willow John and Grandpa and Grandma looked straight ahead. The preacher had a hard time getting started again. He didn't mention the frog. Maybe when the preacher said Lord and the frog said La Roop, the frog was answering for Willow John, and so he cried. So Little Tree says he thought on it. Grandpa never commented on it, and so I thought on it over the years. I figured it was Willow John's way of saying what he had to say. His people were broken and lost, scattered from these mountains that was their home, and lived upon by the preacher and others there in the church. He couldn't fight, and so he wore his hat in church. The preacher had tried to give a sermon to get him to take it off in church. He wouldn't take it off. So maybe when the preacher said Lord and the frog said La Roop, the frog was answering for Willow John, and so he cried. It broke some of the bitterness. After that, Willow John's eyes always twinkled and showed little black lights when he looked at me. May our practice and our lives be dedicated to being fully human and to the momentum towards being fully human for all.